So that's funny. And it's also funny because I grew up in North Carolina, which is the heart of NASCAR country. And I think prayers like that have been prayed, let me be honest. Now, here's what's also funny about that clip, I think, is because it's a picture of what I actually think many of us do when we come to God or we come to Jesus. That whenever we come to God or come to Jesus, I think we all have a picture of who He is and what He can do for us. And then we relate to Him in that way, that our prayers or our relationship with Him is often governed by the picture we have of Him and who He is and the expectations that we have of what we think He'll do for us. I became a follower of Jesus when I was a teenager. And I remember then I had a picture of Jesus, and I really kind of thought, Jesus, would you just sort of help me make good grades? Would you get me through high school? Would you help me be popular? Would you keep me out of trouble? And would you always take care of me? And I didn't really have any thought whatsoever about Jesus' plans for my life, or if Jesus had an agenda for my life. It was pretty much about my agenda and my plans and what I wanted and how I could get Jesus in on my goals and my agenda and what I wanted. And what's interesting is I think we all still do that. I don't know that I've fully outgrown that. And even when you read through the Gospels, which we've been reading during Lent, we've read through the Gospel of Matthew together, even the disciples began following Jesus with that same sort of self-centered sense of what are we going to get out of it. In fact, look at what happened. This is in Matthew 19. This is the end of the Gospels. It says this. We'll put it on the screen. It said, Peter answered him. This is one day. He said, we have left everything to follow you. What then will there be for us? And Jesus said, you guys are pathetic. I'll just go find 12 other disciples who aren't so self-centered. Okay, Jesus didn't say that. but Peter did say the first part. He basically gets to the end and he's like, we've left everything to follow you. When are we going to get something out of this? Because he was still focused on, and most of the disciples were still focused on that. And yet Jesus is gracious and he's merciful and he's patient with them. And he knows that even when they first started following him, they pretty much started following with self-centered motives, a sense of what they were going to get out of it and how they were going to add Jesus to what they wanted in their lives. And yet over time, these disciples were able to lay aside those expectations. They had their expectations of what Jesus would do for them. But over time, and it didn't happen overnight, right? It took a long period of time, but over a period of 3 years, all of these disciples were able to take their expectations of who they thought Jesus was and what he would do for them and how they would benefit from following him. And they were able to make this emotional transition to not just following Jesus for what they thought they would get out of it, but for simply following him for who he was. All of the disciples were able to make that transition slowly over time, except one. And his name was Judas. You see, Judas had his own expectations when he began following Jesus. He had his own picture of who Jesus was and what Jesus would do for him. In fact, that was part of Judas's problem. Judas sort of added Jesus to his own plan or to his own agenda. For Judas, Jesus is always just a means to an end, a means to fulfill whatever expectations he had for what he thought Jesus would do. And you know what Judas's expectations were based on? They were actually based on the Old Testament. Because Judas had these expectations of what the Messiah would be like, and all Jewish sort of followers of Jesus, or all Jews at that time, had this picture of who the Messiah was, that God was going to send a Messiah one day. As Brian mentioned before, he was going to be a political or a military figure who was going to rescue and redeem and sort of lead Israel out of bondage from the Romans and their Roman oppressors at the time. That God would raise up a Messiah that would do that. And the Messiah, he would be just like David was, his great king, or he would be like Hezekiah was his great king, or even this guy named Judas Maccabeus. He was the last great deliverer for the people of Israel. And so that was their model. And so Judas was sort of waiting for God to send this Messiah who would defeat the Roman armies, release them from oppression, and restore the kingdom of Israel. And Jesus shows up, and Jesus kind of looks like he fits the bill. And all he talks about is the kingdom of God is here, and it's coming, and he's about to bring some sort of rescue or redemption to Israel. And so as Judas is looking at Jesus, and as Judas begins to follow Jesus, he seems to think, man, this guy knows what he's talking about. He knows the law. He understands God. He seems like he's sent from God. He can perform miracles. He can do all these amazing things that nobody can even explain. So he kind of looks a lot like the Messiah. But there were a few problems. Jesus was just too passive, right? I mean, he never got riled up to hate the Romans enough. And he was always talking about nonviolence. You're never going to lead an army or a military if you keep talking that way, Jesus. And Jesus wasn't very organized either. I mean, if you're going to launch a new kingdom and start a new government, you got to have a good organization. You have to have good leaders. And Judas looks around at the people that Jesus is asked to follow, and he thinks, like, Andrew, come on now. That dude has no initiative. Thomas, he's always doubting. Peter, sticking his foot in his mouth. Bartholomew, who is that? Nobody knows him. And so Judas is thinking, you've got to get organized and you've got to get the right people around you if you're going to start and launch this kingdom movement. Jesus would never side with the Jewish leaders either. They're the ones who hated the Romans the most. And if you're going to start a revolution, you got to get them on your side. But Jesus was always making them mad too. And then maybe the biggest thing was Jesus then didn't care about raising any money. And if you're going to start a new government and you're going to start a new kingdom, if you're going to overthrow the Romans, you got to build up a war chest. You got to raise money and get financial backing. And Judas was a money guy. He knew how important this was. And yet every time he turns around, it's like Jesus is just giving their money away. And he doesn't seem to care about that. And so Judas starts following Jesus, and everything looks like Jesus is the right guy and looks like Jesus might be the Messiah they've been waiting for. But he just has this nagging feeling that as they're closing in on 3 years of following Jesus, Jesus, when are you going to like finally take charge? When are you going to become the Messiah? When are you going to lead into the role that God has made you for? And Judas couldn't let go of that. He couldn't let go of those expectations. And even though the other 11 disciples, slowly over time, they brought those same expectations into this whole thing. Even though slowly over time, over the course of 3 years, they were able to stop and say, you know, Jesus isn't really doing what we thought he was going to do. He's not really fulfilling my expectations the way I thought. This isn't the kind of Messiah I thought he was going to be. And yet, slowly over time, they were able to come to the place where they were able to say, but we're going to trust you anyways. This isn't what we thought we were going to get out of it. But we're going to trust you anyways. Judas couldn't do that. He couldn't let go of the dream that one day Jesus would finally fulfill all the expectations that he had been waiting for. And it eventually drove him over the edge. In fact, look at how it happens. This is from the book of Matthew, which we've been reading together, in chapter 26, verse 6. One day it says, while Jesus was in Bethany, in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. Now, sometimes there's four books in the New Testament that are about Jesus, and sometimes they tell the same story. John actually tells us this story too, and he adds a couple of details. So I want to flip over to John and read you a few things about what happens next from the book of John. This is what it says. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. Now, he did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Now, here's what's going on. They're at this man's home, and we actually find out it's Lazarus and Mary and Martha. And these are good friends of Jesus. Lazarus plays a role in one of Jesus' big stories. And Mary and Martha are friends as well. And we also think that they're fairly wealthy. And so one day they're in their home and we find out that it's actually Mary. She's the woman that did this. She takes this bottle of perfume and she pours it all over Jesus' head and his feet. And this bottle of perfume is so expensive. It's worth a year's wages. So think about however much money you make in a year. So we're talking thousands and thousands of dollars here. 30, 40, 50,000, 100,000. Well, I don't know, but 50,000, 30,000, whatever. Like, you figure it out for yourself. But it's a lot of money for one bottle of perfume. And she breaks it over his head and she's pouring all over. And Judas is sitting there going, I can't. Why is she doing this? And if we go back to Matthew, we see that Judas is the one that gets them all riled up, because in Matthew it continues. And it says this, Matthew 26, when the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste? They asked. This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. Aware of this, Jesus said to them, why are you bothering this woman? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. And when she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Now, this isn't really about the poor. The disciples have never really talked about the poor in this way. They're not always giving money to the poor. There's no indication that this is like this deep conviction on their hearts. But Jesus decides to address it anyways. And he says, look, you'll always have the poor with you. And this is a fascinating verse because he's actually quoting the Old Testament. There's a verse in Deuteronomy that says, you will always have the poor with you. Therefore, you always have an opportunity to be generous to the poor. Not like ignore the poor, but you always have great opportunities to show generosity because that's your role, to help those who are poor. And so Jesus sort of calls on this verse, in essence basically saying, we'll always have the poor with us and we always have those opportunities. But in this one instance, in this one moment, right here, right now, she did the right thing. She worshiped me. She was generous towards me. She made the right choice. And then he basically says, symbolically, you know what she was doing? This is a few days before the cross. She was preparing my body for burial. And Judas hears all this, and he's had enough. He can't take it. Because as we're told, he was the person who oversaw the finances. Now we're told he was also the person who skimmed a little off the top for himself along the way. And we don't know if that was for himself or maybe he was building up his own treasury. But the most important thing is he was the money guy. He was the treasurer. He was the CFO of this operation, right? And you know how CFOs are, right? They've got their eyes on all the dollars and he just can't believe here Jesus is again. What a waste. Why would Jesus do this? And then in Jesus' response, he says, this woman did the right thing. And then he starts talking about death and burial again. And he's been doing a lot of that lately. And that doesn't make any sense. That does not fit into the plan. What does that mean? That's not what a victorious Messiah would look like. And it's almost as if in this moment, in this instance, it was the final straw for Judas. Because look at what happens immediately following. Then, one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and he asked, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him over to you? So they counted out for him 30 pieces of silver. And from then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. You see, it was just too much for Judas. If you're not going to do it my way, Jesus, you've left me no option than to take matters into my own hands. If you're not going to conform to the Messiah that we all know you should be, if you're not going to be the person that we all decided to follow, well, then you're forcing me to do something that I'm just going to have to do. I'm going to have to make you into the person that we all thought you would be. And we don't know exactly what Judas is thinking at this point, why he goes and betrays Jesus to the Jewish leadership. Maybe he's switching sides. Maybe he decides they're the ones he needs to cast his lot with. Probably probably what was going on is Judas was thinking, I'm just going to force his hand. I'm just going to force him into the role. That maybe this will finally get him to take action and do something about it. And yet, we stand back and we read the story and we have to stop and pause and think, how could somebody who's been following Jesus for 3 years, has seen all of the miracles, has given his life to this movement, how could somebody who's so sold out and bought in go from that place to deciding to betray and turn his back on Jesus? I mean, how could somebody go from one extreme to the other? I think what it does is it gives us some insight into the dynamics of human nature. Because we actually see this in our own culture all the time, don't we? We see it in marriage. We see a man and a woman stand at the altar one day and say, I want to give my entire life to you. I want to love you. I love you more than anyone else. I want to spend the rest of my life with you more than anyone else. And a few years later, things have gotten so bad that they basically say, I despise you. I can't be around you. I don't want to spend any more time with you. I don't want to see you anymore for the rest of my life. And we ask, like, how can somebody go from one extreme to the other? How can they be so in love and so committed and so sold out and so into somebody and then stand up and say that they hate that person more than any other person in the world? And the reason is the same reason that was happening in Judas's heart and in Judas's life. And simply this, there's tremendous power and unmet expectations. There's tremendous power and unmet expectations. I mean, think about any broken relationship you've had in your life. Think about the marriage that maybe didn't work. Think about the jobs that haven't worked out. Think about a relationship that hasn't worked out. Think about all of the relational frustration that you've experienced with other people, the resentment that you've experienced towards friends, towards a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a spouse or a family member or a parent. Think about that, and at the heart of it probably was an unmet expectation. Because there's tremendous power in unmet expectations. And Judas had a picture of who Jesus was and who Jesus was going to be and what Jesus was going to do for him and the expectations that Jesus needed to meet. And Jesus just wasn't following through. And I think the same thing can happen in your life and in my life. That the longer we follow Jesus, the more that we see he doesn't always meet our expectations. And when you bump up against one of those scenarios in your life or you go through a difficult season, and as Blake said earlier, maybe you've spent a lot of your life negotiating with him and you get to the point where you can't negotiate anymore. And you're in one of those seasons where the way you see Jesus is very different than he's acting. Or the perspective that he has on your life is different than the perspective you want to have on your life. Or the perspective he has on money or your work or your family or an issue is different than the perspective you want to have on that. You come to one of those places where your expectations and what you think he should be doing and how he should be intervening aren't being met. Then you have a significant choice. I mean, like the other disciples, you can say, you know what? This isn't how I thought it was going to go. This isn't what I thought he was like. In fact, he's totally different. This isn't what I thought I was going to get out of it, but I've seen enough and I've experienced enough to know that I can trust Jesus and that I don't have all the answers, and maybe my way is flawed, and maybe my expectations were wrong, and so I'm going to trust in him. And that's hard, because the temptation for most of us is going to be like Judas. It's going to be to say, you know what, my plan is better than yours, Jesus. My expectations are better than yours. My view of who you are and what you should be doing is way better than yours. And we would never say that out loud. But if we believe it like Judas did, we'll take matters into our own hands, just like Judas did. And he decided to stick with his own plan, and he decided to try to force Jesus' hand. And the consequences, as most of us know, were devastating. Matthew tells us a few days later that Jewish leadership came after Jesus. And Judas was the one who betrayed him, and he turned him over to the authorities. And they arrested Jesus, and they took him to trial, and they sentenced him to death because he didn't conform to people's expectations. And when this happened, it says, when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse. And he returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and to the elders. I've sinned, he said, for I've betrayed innocent blood. What is that to us? They replied. That's your responsibility. So Judas threw the money into the temple and he left. And then he went away and hanged himself. You see, I don't think Judas knew what his actions were going to lead to. I think that's why he probably thought he was forcing Jesus' hand. That maybe by doing this, maybe by getting Jesus arrested, Jesus would finally say, all right, now it's time. And he would like throw off the cloak and lightning bolts would shoot out of his chest. And he would finally become the Messiah that Judas has been waiting for all the time. And then they can get to the real argument, which they had been having all along. Once his kingdom comes, what's going to be your place and what's going to be my place? And who's going to sit at his right hand and who's going to sit? That was what Judas was waiting for. And so he thought, maybe this is the way to force it to happen. But when Judas saw that the outcome of his actions was not that at all, it says he was seized with remorse. And he couldn't deal with it. So he went and hung himself. And we look at this and we read this and we say, what a tragedy. I mean, he followed Jesus for 3 years with mixed motives probably the whole time. And he never got his way. He was probably frustrated following Jesus for 3 years. And then he took matters into his own hands and he still didn't get his way. And Judas, I think, learned the lesson the hard way that probably all of us have to learn at some point. That Jesus isn't just a means to an end. That Jesus can't just be an add-on to our own plans or to our own agenda. That we can't just bring in our own expectations of what Jesus is going to be for us in our lives. That we don't just add Jesus to our lives to make things smoother or better or to help us accomplish what we want to accomplish. That's not the role Jesus wants to play. He wants to be the Lord. He wants to be the king. He's the leader. We're the followers. And maybe for you today, that just means the challenge is simple. Maybe this is somewhat new. Maybe you're reconnecting with God. Maybe you're coming back to church, or maybe something's happened and it's been a difficult season and you're looking to God for help. And maybe for you, the challenge is simply just saying, Jesus, I want to follow you. And I don't know where that's leading. And I know that my expectations are probably going to be turned upside down. But I'm willing to take that risk. And I want to start following you. Maybe for a lot of us, if you've been following him for a long time, maybe it's asking this question. Am I in it for him? Or am I in it for me? Because it's pretty easy to be following him for a long time and still be in it for yourself and what you want to get out of it. And so I just think I need to constantly ask my question, this question in my heart and in my mind. Am I in this for what I'm going to get out of it? or am I simply in this because he's the Lord and he's the king and I'll follow him wherever he leads? And the lesson of Judas's life is you can't have it both ways. You can't both lead and follow. And when you're following him and the expectations you bring into it don't work, you're going to reach that point where you're going to have to say, am I willing to give up those expectations, to surrender those expectations? Or am I going to be like Judas? Or am I going to keep trying to force him into the role that I want him to be? Because if you do, you'll take matters into your own hands. And you might not have as tragic a story as Judas, and you might not leave the faith, and you might not renounce all of your beliefs. But there'll be those circumstances where he's not doing what you want him to do, and you'll just decide to do what you want to do instead. And you'll embrace beliefs, you'll embrace patterns, you'll embrace actions, you'll embrace habits or behaviors that'll bring far more suffering, far more self-destruction in your life than you ever would have had you just let go of your expectations and followed him. And you see, following Jesus is ultimately about trust, and it's about surrender. Do we trust Jesus enough when he doesn't meet our expectations that we're willing to surrender our expectations? You see, true surrender starts with our beliefs. That's often where it starts when we first start following Jesus. We surrender our old beliefs and adopt some new beliefs. And that can be hard, but it's not that hard, right? And then it starts with changing and surrendering some of our actions and our patterns and our habits, leaving behind some old ones and adopting some new ones. But true surrender ultimately leads to a place where you have to surrender your actual expectations of where you thought all of this was going and what you are going to get out of it. And Judas couldn't do that. He surrendered some of his beliefs, probably even some of his actions, but when it came to his expectations, he couldn't surrender them. And if it can happen to someone like Judas, who followed Jesus for 3 years in the flesh, saw the miracles with his own eyes, if it can happen to him, it could probably happen to any one of us. But the other 11 disciples, they did it. Slowly over time, they were able to say, Jesus, I'm going to surrender my expectations. This isn't going where I thought it was going to go, but I'm going to trust you and follow you. And Jesus said, yes, and I'll change your life as a result, and I'll change the world as a result. And we name our kids after those disciples, right? Nobody names their child Judas. He couldn't let go of the expectations he had. So here's the question I want to end with. What expectations do you have that have been difficult to surrender? Where are you feeling frustrated in your life because God just isn't doing what you think he should be doing? He's not acting the way you think he should be acting. And would you be willing today to come to that place and say, I'm frustrated, Jesus, with you and with God and the Holy Spirit and however that all works. And I'm frustrated with the whole situation and I don't have any good answers. And I realize part of my frustration is I've brought my own expectations into this. And I don't know how to do this very well, Jesus, but I want to surrender those. Would you give me the strength and the faith to surrender them, to stop trying to do the leading myself and start simply following? Let me pray. Father God, we all have expectations that we place on you. Help us to come to the place where we surrender those. Not just for the sake of self-denial, but so that we can experience what you have to offer us that's so much better. So much better than our expectations. You have a life and grace and joy and purpose and peace to give us. Just like you had all those things to give Judas. Help us to let go of what we need to let go of in order to experience the life that you want to give us. We pray all this in your name. Amen.
You stood before creation.